Okay, gentlemen, today's daf in Masechet Yevamot brought to you Me'eretz HaKodesh is daf Kuf Chof, and we're getting up to the end very quickly here. You better get your new Gemaras ready. And let me just remind you where we are. We're holding right now on the last three words of Kuf Yotes Omud Beis. Now here's the deal. It's very important to get a perspective on what's been happening with Rabbi Elazar and the mysterious Orient Express. So remember that we had a machlokas in the Mishnah, and we have no idea really what precisely the machlokas is based on. The Mishnah, we talk about two cases in the Mishnah. One of the cases is where you have two sister-in-laws, okay? Each one of them is saying, my husband died. Now, the impact of her husband died ought to mean, if both husbands died, that both women are allowed to marry, right? Because we believe a woman who comes back from overseas and says that her husband died. If we believe her, so then by definition, that means that the other woman's, who was the sister-in-law, the other woman's yavam died. And therefore, there's no husband and there's no yavam. But the Mishnah says, no, we only believe each woman about her own husband in terms of her own ability to marry. However, we cannot believe her about the other woman's ability to marry without chalitza. And therefore, since we don't have that yavam, until we find out that the yavam died, each one of them is going to aser on the other one. And we will not believe the woman of the respective yavam to say that her husband died where it's nogea the other person. That was the first case. In that case, we did not find any machlokas. Now, in the last case, we had a situation exactly the same, except in that case, there were additional one brother apiece here. And what happened was, is that each one of these women indeed did not marry the yavam who had disappeared. But she went ahead and she married the other yavam because there were two additional brothers who were available. So each one of them married another yavam. Now what happened is that these yavamim died. So now there is a new problem. Do we go back to the fact that, well, wait a minute, they died, they required yibum because they didn't have any kids. And as far as we know, the original brothers that went overseas are still alive. I mean, not totally alive. They're only somewhat alive. In other words, each one is only alive for creating the problem with the alternative woman whose husband he isn't, right? But I mean, l'chora, we're thrown back into the original case because now there's a new chiyuv of yibum from these new brothers and those original yavamim. We never adequately established whether they were dead or alive in terms of yibum. We knew they were dead in terms of marriage. So the question is, does that make a difference? Suddenly appears Rabbi Elazar, and he says, yes, it makes a big difference. Because once we allowed them to marry these brothers, even though these brothers die, at that point, for some reason, they remain mutter. So yesterday, we had two ways of learning that question. And I'm going to stick with Tosfos's approach because it's so much more reasonable. And maybe I'll just mention Rashi's approach, but we'll see why it's very unreasonable. So Tosfos's approach is very straightforward. There's two ways of understanding Rabbi Elazar. According to one approach, Rabbi Elazar says as follows. Even though it's true that there are these five or seven women that are not believed to be married to their respective alternative, whether it's the sister-in-law, whether it's the other wife, whatever the case is, mother-in-law, daughter-in-law, all of those cases, that's only where they were actually coming to give testimony directly affecting the other woman without it's necessarily affecting them. So let's imagine a case where a tzara was divorced anyway, right? So now she doesn't care. And she's only coming to say, listen, you know, he died, and therefore this other woman, the other woman in my life, is now allowed to get married. Okay, now over there we won't believe her. You're right, because they hate each other. Fine. But what about in a case where the topic, the reason, the whole point of my testimony is really, it's not all about you, honey. It's about me. I want to get married. And I'm telling you, my husband is dead. And if you think that all I can think about is saying my husband is dead because of you, you got some pretty severe psychological problems. Okay, so that's what Rabbi Elazar is saying. If the woman is coming to discuss herself and nobody else, and once we accept her testimony about herself, so then it turns out as an ancillary result that if we believe her that the husband is dead, well, the husband to her is the yavam to the other her, right? So, I mean, the same person can't be both dead and alive, as Einstein argued. And therefore, there should be, in this case, no problem of accepting her edus. That's one way of understanding Rabbi Elazar. Now, note that according to that approach, the truth is that Rabbi Elazar argued in the first case of the Mishnah as well. Because the first case in the Mishnah, each one was coming to decide what the did was for themselves, not for the other one. Okay, but that doesn't bother me so much because very often we find that a shita waits until the end and then argues. So that's okay. That's Tosis's approach. According to Rashi, what Rava was asking was perhaps Rabbi Elazar argues on the entire halacha of these five women who are not ne'emanot, which is very problematic. That means all through the perek, we never heard a word from him until now. And it's not that there's something that came up now that was different. That, you know, this is the first time that we've dealt with this new issue where each woman is only interested in herself, and nonetheless, we're not going to apply it according to Tanakhama. So there is Tosfos says it makes sense to say this is a new issue, and he argues on it. Anyway, that's one possibility as applied by either Tosfos or Rashi that Rava raises. Now, the other possibility is that, well, even if she came and gave testimony, Rabbi Elazar would not say, it ain't all about you, honey. Maybe it is. Maybe hatred runs deep. But in the last case, and only in the last case of the Mishnah, where over there, she actually went, each one of them actually went ahead and did a terrible thing in the event that the husband is alive. And they each went and got Yibam from another brother who was here in town. Now, over there, each one of them is doing a terrible Isser. She's an Ashes Ish if the husband is alive. And worse, she's sleeping with her brother-in-law. And in terms of the consequences for her, the consequences indeed, if the husband shows up, are going to be catastrophic. I mean, this woman is out from society. Forget all of the other issues. And there, Rabbi Elazar is saying, look, if she hadn't gone herself and married a Yavam, I would agree to you. We have to worry that she's only saying my husband is dead because she wants to mess up her tzora or her yavama, whatever the case may be. But over here, you're telling me that she was ready to screw up her whole life only in order to prove, I mean, what did she have to do that for? She didn't have to go and take the yavama. That's why Rabbi Elazar is arguing, in which case Rabbi Elazar would not have argued on the first case in our Mishnah, because in the first case of our Mishnah, all she did was came along and testified. But she did not in any way mess up her life by actually going ahead and doing something that could cause her all of these problems later. So that was Rava's question yesterday. The practical difference between those two approaches is very obvious, the way that we just explained it. Because according to approach number one, Rabbi Elazar would argue even in the first case of the Mishnah, where they did not go ahead and actively do something to mess themselves up. Mashenken, according to approach number two, Rabbi Elazar is only arguing in the second part of the Mishnah. That's correct. And therefore, when we're asking now, so what's the difference? What do you mean, what's the difference? Obviously, what the difference is. How do we understand the Mishnah? Is Rabbi Elazar arguing on the beginning or not? But the question that we're asking now, Lamai Nafkamina, which is the beginning of today's daf, Lamai Nafkamina is being asked about the general term, tzarot. Because Rava said, does he not hold of the entire chashash of tzarot? Now, in that sense, we use tzarot as a general term, including the other woman that is going to be affected along with her. It could have meant the Yavama, could have meant the tzara, but it also means a tzara. I would like to know, is there a case about a tzara where there's a real tzara, not a tzara as a Yavama? Is there a case about a tzara that will be a different outcome depending on how we understand the logic of Rabbi Elazar? That's the question of Lamai Nafkamina. So today the Gemara answers first word on Amud Aleph and Kuf Chaf, that Nafkamina is Le'insu Ve'Litzara Mikame Dida. If you're telling me that all we want to be Matir, according to Rabbi Elazar, is in a case where the woman actually went ahead and married on the basis of her testimony. In the case of the Mishnah, she married a Yovan. In the case of a Tzara, the difference would be like this. She shows up, she says, I want a heter to get married. We give her the heter, and the Tzara, we give a heter. Now the question is, can she marry based on just the heter, or does she have to actually go ahead and do it? So if you're going to tell me that the only logic of Rabbi Elazar is that she was actually willing to mess up her life, we're not going to allow the tzara to get a heter until we watch this woman who claims her husband is dead. I want to see you jump off the roof. So if she jumps off the roof, meaning she marries another guy, and she takes the chance of all of those horrific consequences. Now I know she's telling the truth, because I don't believe she's going to destroy herself just to mess up the tzara. But if we only gave her the heter, and so now the tzara comes along and says, well, the bezdin was mat to her, so can I get married too? We'll say, no, madam, you cannot get married until we watch the tzara jump off the roof. That's the difference. So the question is, do we allow the tzara to go first before the first woman to be meida that her husband died, who is her husband being the yavam? Do we allow that tzara? Or, and that's the case here, but here, sorry, we're not talking about Yovam, we're talking about the other woman who's married to the same guy. So if you're going to tell me tzara mi'ida l'chaverta in general, as long as the focus is her own testimony for her own future, so then fine, then we believe her, because it's not about you, honey. Okay, so then afak abdolayin, even though she did not jump off the roof, nonetheless, we allow the other one to go first, because we believe that she gave this testimony. And it wasn't about the tzara, it's just ancillary. So then minasvina lo tzara first. But if you're going to tell me that the entire logic of it is, mishum dehilo mekalkala nafsha, she would not jump off the roof just to prove that her tzara should be messed up, and that's crazy, says Rabbi Elazar. So then we have to wait until she jumps. So if she went ahead and she married herself based on her own supposed testimony that her husband died, okay, then we believe her because she was ready to jump. So then, minasvina l'tzara, from that point forward, we will allow the tzara to marry. But if we don't watch her jump off the roof, lo intziv, we will not allow her. Now that is big nafkamina lagabi, any tzara, and not only lagabi the yavama, which is the case of our Mishnah. Okay, are we happy? Is Dr. Barry jumping? Is he dancing as fast as he can? I don't know. Just because it's 4 o'clock in the morning, he's not dancing as fast as he can? What the heck? All right. Maybe he got a little bit tired. So let's see if we can bring a raya. My, says the Gemara. Do we have a raya or not? Yes, we do, says the Gemara. Take a look at the lashon of the Mishnah. Here is what Rabbi Elazar says, that Rabbi Elazar Amir, ho'il v'hu tru le'yavin. But he didn't say since they got married to the Yavama. He says since the court was matir them. So therefore, they're v'hu tru l'kol adam, which is mashma, that there is not a need to actually go ahead. So what is going on? Well, let me spell it out to you. I mean, if you're going to tell me that the point of Rabbi Elazar is that she's not mekakala nafsha. So we're saying over here, okay, so it's only because she's not going to destroy herself, and therefore if she goes ahead and she gets married, so then we marry her off. But if you're going to tell me that in general, Why are we bringing up the question of whether she was going to be married or not? That's not important, because it's just a fact that she was made. If it would be ancillary edus, it should also be okay, even in this, not only in this, the last case, but even in the first case. But over here it says only in the last case. Why? Because the last case is where she would be able to go ahead and actually get married. So you see that it's only because the insiv, and she won't destroy herself. No, not true. Because, listen, put yourself in Rabbi Elazar's place, okay? You're arguing with the Rabbanan. The Rabbanan are telling you these two cases. So you're saying, look, gentlemen, I disagree with the whole thing. I think that it's a little bit exaggerated to think that a woman is coming along to talk about her dead husband, is asking for permission to marry, and it's all about someone else. I mean, that is not normal psychology. So we should not be chayshish for something that is really pathological. And okay, you don't hold it. I understand. So let's look at the closing case in the Mishnah, okay? How about over there? Don't you agree over there? Where the woman actually destroys her own life, she jumps off the roof, and there you're going to say, well, she only did that because that way we will believe her to mess up her tzara. I mean, even you've got to agree that that is super duper pathological. I mean, why in the world would the Rabbanan be chayshish for a case like that? Maybe that's all the Rebbe Elazar was saying. It's not that he was saying what his own logic is. He's trying to explain, look, it's true, there are two steps. I take both steps, but you should at least admit that the latter step, where she's literally jumping off the roof, that should be enough of a proof that it's not about someone else. So I would say like this, let's see that inside. Rabbi Elazar is only speaking to the Chachamim in terms of their own way of thinking it. What he's basically saying is, look, Lididi, as far as I'm concerned, both of these cases are irrelevant. She's not focused on somebody else. She's focused on herself and her own future. And in general, under those circumstances, as we learned at Lactosis, Dafka, under those circumstances, Tzora is Me'ida L'Chaverta. What is this with the Gabbai over here? You're giving actual new ammunition to the guy sitting next to you over there, Barnea. Every time I take a sip, you take a double sip just to make me Tzoras. Man, oh man. You can't trust anybody anymore. So, I understand. That's my feeling. But at least admit that I'm right about the last case. Leditchu, at least Odoli Miat, agree that in this last case where she actually already jumped off the roof. Dehecha de Intziv. Mansevin and La. And of course, we already know the Rabbanan's approach to this. They told us before, it's all about Shimshon. Didn't Shimshon bring the house down on his own head? Well, that's what she's doing. Tamut nafshi im plishtim is what she's saying. And I never saw a bigger plishti than this tzara. So what the heck? We go together. So the Rabbanan say, Tamut nafshi im plishtim hudika avda. Okay, so then we don't have a raya. So let's go back to the drawing boards and see if we can bring a raya. Tashma. Ha'isha shalchahi u'ba'ala l'medinat hayam. Now here's a braita. A woman goes together with her husband to medinat hayam. U'ba'av amrash comes back. She says, my husband died. Okay, classic case. She gets married and we paskin in the end. Like Beit Shammai, Beit Hillel agreed. She gets her ketuvah. Everything's fine. But her tzara cannot get married just because she's believed for herself. Rabbi Elazar Omer, now, come on. I mean, if she's allowed to get married, then her tzara is allowed to get married. But it says hutra. It doesn't say she married. It says we were matir her to marry. So does that not imply, and we could have made this diuk before, but over there it was necessary to tell us there's a difference between a case where she's involved. But here, hovu hutra, so she's hutra, even though she didn't marry. So in other words, as long as the coming to Beis Din and being meida that the husband died was focused on her own future, we believe her for the tzara. I don't know. I mean, that could mean hutra v'niseit. I mean, that's not what we're focusing on over here. I don't understand your entire idea over here. Excuse me. Because the whole thing doesn't make any sense. You're saying that the nafka mina will be if she goes ahead and gets married first. So then we will believe her according to this second shot. But if she doesn't get married first, we won't believe her. If she has to get married first, how can we believe her? Even if she does get married first. How do we know that what really happened overseas was not that her husband divorced her? And we don't know about that divorce, do we? So she comes back and she says, what a great opportunity to destroy the other woman. So she has a get, but she doesn't let on she has a get. Oh, my dear Tsara, a terrible thing has happened. Our joint husband has dropped dead. I guess you better go and get married. I'm going to go get married. I know he's dead. Okay, so she goes and gets married. And she only gets married because she's not messing herself up. She gets married because she's got to get. Now, how do you know that that's not the case? So in the case in the Mishnah where we're talking about the Yavama, now there we know that the Yavama really messed up her life because she went and married her brother-in-law. There's no way that that's going to happen. But in this case where she was not, it had nothing to do with the Yavama, it was only a question of whether is she still married or not. How do we know she's not married and pretending to be married, not letting on to her divorce, and just being there to mess up someone else? The advantage, Gershi, in considering these issues is that it brings to light in your mind the horrific nature of reality. And even though you are incapable of thinking thoughts like this, the point in the Gemara is you've got to learn what's out there. And this is what humanity is all about. So it stinks. But okay. So therefore, how do you know, according to Rebbe Elazar, that you could even be mater her in the case where she came back, jumped off of the roof? She didn't jump off the roof. She had a parachute, a golden parachute, a get. Amazing. So how do you know? And she's only saying the husband dead because she's got this amazing plan to wipe out her tzara. If I was divorced, she's going to be worse than divorced, right? Says the Gemara, it's true. When we said we're looking for a case where there's an nafka mina, you're right. The nafka mina would not be in a case where she comes back and gets married. We wouldn't believe her in that case. But how about if she goes and gets married to a kohen? Aha! So now, if the husband comes back and says, how dare you? What do you mean? You said I was dead. Bah, you're not dead. I have a get. Her husband says, a get? I'm a kohen. And anyway, she's messed up, right? So therefore, that's the case what it's talking about. The insiv lekohen. Sorry, we're only looking for a theoretical case where with nafka mina. So we found a theoretical case with the nafka mina. And now we are ready for an important moment with our kapitan, who still is not on the front porch and is still not sharing the island with us. And that's very disturbing. Oh, you could drink coffee on the front porch, for heaven's sakes.
We look forward to this.
Yeah. What's going on, Rich? You might as well be back in the old city. The same wood color, the same jazz. And I mean, how do we know? You know what? I'm beginning to have my doubts about this whole thing. It's probably just a background for Zoom.
Right, it's a Zoom background.
What a phony.
One who has phony background shouldn't throw rocks at... Anyway, Zoot Helika
Mishnah. Now we enter into a whole new issue. Now this issue is very, very connected to Bava Metzia, as we'll soon see. Because the question is, on what basis do we actually identify these people that are coming? They say your husband died. If the case is that they had to identify a body, okay, how do you identify a body? Now, remember, I mean, it could be talking about, of course, a case where they don't need to identify the body. They watch the guy drowning or they watch the guy being shot. That's a different case. But what if they identify a body. Maybe the guy drowned. Now, somebody drowned. They pulled him out of the water. We're going to identify the body. Now, remember that there are two fundamentally different ways of identification. One is called tviut eina. Tviut eina is the way that we identify people in general. If I ask you to describe to me Akiva, he's in shul, and I need to call him out. I never met him. Could you describe him for me? His wife is waiting outside. Would you be certain that you could describe him well enough to me that I would find him? No. On the other hand, if I know Akiva, so then you just say, call Akiva. Well, how'd you know he was Akiva? What do you mean, how do you know he was Akiva? What, am I crazy? I recognize him. Can you tell us what you mean when you say you recognize him? I mean, if I was talking to an AI, he would give me all kinds of mathematical descriptions of precisely the interrelationships of topography of the various features on his face and so on, in which it's 100% Akiva, but he has no idea who Akiva is. You, who claim to have every idea who Akiva is, can't give me one single explanation of how is that Akiva. Now, isn't that weird? So that's one function of optical recognition by humans where they can't give you the data. But there's another way in which could identify Akiva. We could say, take the guy with the bright red scarf. There's only one guy in the whole shul that wears a bright red scarf, right? So you could say that. But then how do we know that that's Akiva? Maybe Akiva lent his bright red scarf to the guy next to him who was freezing and chattering, and Akiva handed him the scarf. Nice guy. We could say the guy with the most beautiful hairdo in the entire Beis HaMedrash. Well, of course, that would be Akiva, naturally, right? But that would be called a simon on his body as opposed to from his clothing. But, I mean, there may be other people with beautiful hairdos too. So, we have different issues over here. One is the question of a siman muvhak. Now, a siman muvhak is something that is unmistakably this person and only this person. So we don't have a siman muvhak for an Akiva, but there are people where we would have a siman muvhak. It's somebody, for instance, there's somebody in my minyan that davens on Shabbos, and he has an extremely large cherry-colored birthmark that covers most of his face. Something that you rarely see, that is a profound disfigurement until you get used to it, and that would be called a simen muvhak. It's something that you rarely will find in anyone else, and therefore I'm giving that as a simen. Now, I could also say that he's a tall guy. That's clearly not a simen muvhak. That may not even be a simen at all. Because, I mean, that's a large part of the population are tall guys. If I say he wears glasses, is that a simon today? At all? No. But I could give simonim that are somewhat in the middle. I could say he is the guy, and those are simonim benonim. Those are simonim that I'd say he's the guy who has a mole next to his right eyelash. Okay, a mole of such and such a coloration. Now, that's not absolutely a simen muvhak, but it certainly is a simen. Then the question of whether a scarf is considered to be a simen, that we saw involves another issue. Because since it's movable from one person to the other, is it a simen? Then there's another problem. Is a red scarf a simen at all? Black scarf, red scarf. There's hundreds of red scarves. So how could you use a common thing like a color of a kli or beged? How could you use that as a simen? That should not be a simen at all. So therefore, basically anything that's mass produced is not going to be called a simen at all. And the basis of simen in the Torah, at least if you hold simonim or d'oraisa of this type, is the fact that the Torah speaks out the feirish, that if you find a simla, you find a dress or a shirt, Now, in those days, there was no such thing as mass production. And therefore, by definition, a simla is identifiable. And that's why you would give it back. So that may mean that the Torah is telling you, give something back on the basis of simonim. But not necessarily. Because people will recognize their own things. And even if it's something that someone else has the same thing, I know that this is mine. This is my talis. Doesn't that happen to you often? You know, the question, you put your talis down. Is this my talis? It takes you a moment, but yeah, this is my talis. Can you tell me exactly how you know this is your talis? No. But you have tvi'as ayin in it, that even though there's another 1,000 talisim in this shul that look exactly like this to the cleaning lady, to you, it's very clear that this is your talis. So the tvi'as ayin, will we give back a mitziah on the basis of tvi'as ayin? The interesting thing is that the only reason that we don't is because we don't trust you. How do we know that you're telling us the truth? The simon you can show us, but the tvi'as ayin you can't show us. So if someone has a track record of ne'emanut, we will return a mitziah to him on the basis of tvi'as ayin, because the best possible raya is tvi'as ayin. A simon is only a secondary raya, but it is a describable and therefore shareable raya. So that's the question that we have over here, and we're going to need to take that into consideration. If you don't know the person, how can you testify about the death of someone that you don't know, and to what stage of decomposition and changes in features after the person drowned can you even be made that you recognize him? Now, that's the questions that we have to raise now. Says the Mishnah, Ein me'idin ela al partzuf panim im hachotam. What you need to have is to be able to actually see his face, to include his nose, his cheekbones, and his forehead. So that's the partzuf panim im hachotam. Even though there are plenty of simonim, he's wearing a particular coat that we know to have been this guy's, and there are other simonim on his body, that is not enough to actually testify, unless you would really recognize him. So that means that if you have, at least that's the way we assume right now, if you have some kind of unusual feature on the body, you can't rely on that unless you can actually identify him on the basis of his face. Now, there's a big machlokas here about what that means. The entire approach, as Tosis brings here, the Rabbeinu Tam, the entire approach of the Rabbeinu Tam is that this is talking about specifically a case where there is no body. There's only a head. And therefore, you need to identify him on the basis specifically of his face. But if there's an entire body with this head, then it would be easy to identify someone with tviut ayin. And therefore, the Rabbeinu Tam considers this to be a unique situation in which I'm called upon to not utilize my normal tviut ayin, where I take into consideration the entire structure of the person's body and his overall looks. Masha Enkin, over here, what I'm trying to do is utilize my standard tviut ayin on a part that I generally do not see without the rest of the body. I mean, unless you're talking about Harry Potter and, you know, I mean, he's got the rest of his body covered, but generally you don't see heads wandering around in the middle of the air. And because of that, you don't recognize them very well. So that's what we're talking about. But if there's a body, says the Rabbeinu Tam, so then if you have tviut ayin, it makes sense that you could still identify it. Furthermore, another interesting thing that the Rabbeinu Tam says is that the other issues that we're going to talk about over here is how much time could have transpired between the person's drowning or his death and my identification does not apply where I'm identifying a complete body. Okay, so we'll see about this as we go. But that means that there's two very, very different ways of understanding the Mishnah. So furthermore, Ein me'idin alav, you cannot say that the guy is dead unless you see him dead. Afilo ra'u meguyad v'tzalu v'rechayau chelet bo. I don't care, even if you saw him cut up and like There's no way that he can live, as far as you understand. So he's got these deep wounds. His legs are cut off, whatever it is. He's actually hanging on a cross. He is being eaten up by a lion. You cannot testify that he's dead unless he is dead. Furthermore, if time has passed from the time of the death until you are called upon to identify the body, it cannot be made once 3 days have passed. Says Rav Yehuda ben Bava, I mean, come on, man, this is so much a function of many interrelated issues. How in the world do you give a naive shear of 3 days? Lo kol adam, lo kol amakom, lo kol ha-sha'ot shavim. I mean, you're telling me it has nothing to do with the weight and the fat of the victim. You're telling me it has nothing to do with the climate. You're telling me it has nothing to do with the particular temperature at that time of the day. It has nothing to do with whether the sun is shining on him or not. I mean, that's stupid. There are so many factors that you cannot possibly give a simple 3 days. What does it mean? 3 days what? And therefore, you cannot make, now Gemara is going to ask, is he saying that you're machmer? Is he coming to be makel? Is he coming just to say it's irrelevant? That we'll see. So turn around, Bonan. If the Edim see only the padachat, they only see the guy's forehead, they do not see his cheekbones, or the opposite, they see only his face, but the top of his head is missing. You need to have the parts of Panim, the padachat, together with the nose. Om Rabbi Vitamer of Kahana, it's a pasuk. Hakarat pnehem antabam. It's not their faces are proof of how horrible they are. It's the hakarat of pnehem, which adds something. So that's adding the padachat. Now, Abba Bar Marta, who is also called Abba Bar Minyumi, now, he was in big trouble. The Reish Galuta's family and entourage were very dangerous people. You do not want to walk by the mafia when you owe money to the mafia, right? But he knew the Mishnah. So what did he do? He took a piece of messed up cloth. He put some glue on it, and he put it over his forehead. When the Yerushalmi, the same thing appears, they put it over his nose. He walked right in front of him. They didn't know who he was. Aha! So you see that you can mess up things very easily. Now look how long it took Apple to finally get those masks part of facial recognition, right? Now, could they do it if the mask goes from the forehead down to the nose instead of the other way around? Aha! So according to this Mishnah, that would be a much greater challenge. All right. So anyway, we said in the Mishnah, even though you do have simanim on the body or on his begodim, you cannot rely on simanim. Now that seems to be saying that when it comes to returning things in Bava Metzia based on simanim, that is not really a din d'oraisa. That is a din d'rabbanan. How could the rabbanan make such a halacha? Mikayach bezdin, hefker bezdin, hefker, right? So in other words, if we need to establish how it is, now, we're going to be returning things in a lost and found. So the only way that we can do that is by allowing simanim. So we allow simanim beinonim, and obviously it could be that simanim muvakim, everybody would be made as d'oraisa. But we will allow these kind of simanim that we allow, but we will not allow it to be over on a d'oraisa. So to give back money, the Bezdin has a right to give money and assign ownership. But to allow someone to get married on the basis of the identification of a dead husband who is only identified with simonim is not good enough. But the problem is that we have another d'oraisa, which shows that that's not true. The other d'oraisa is the delivery of a get. And the problem over here was that the person who's delivering the get lost the get. Now it's found. So in order for us to be able to be samech that this get is the get that was lost, and this could be, look, if it was lost in a location where it could have fallen from anyone, I mean, to say that there's no one of that name who's married to a woman of her name, who knows? You're talking about millions of people. We're talking about a place where caravans come by. You find the get in an airport. I mean, for heaven's sakes, it could have come from anywhere in the world, right? So if you find that get, and it's tied to his personal carry-on, let's say, or it's tied to his personal wallet, or it's tied to the ring that he uses as his embossing ring, his signet ring. That was in those days, that was the way that you legalized the document. Or you found it maybe with his personal things, maybe in home. I don't care how many years have passed. It's obviously a kosher get because it's got to be the same get that had fallen. How can you give a get based on simonim if you just prove that simonim are not the oraisa based on our Mishnah? A get is no different than a testimony that the guy died. You're allowing an Eishes Ish to get married. So what's the difference? Amar Abaye, there's a big difference only because it depends who the sheet is. But you're right. Lokasha, the Braita was going according to Rabbi Eliezer ben Mahavai, and he holds Simonim are the Oraisa, whereas the case over here in the Mishnah was going a Libet Rabbanan. I know that there's a machlokas like this. Listen to me, man. The Tanya, it says in the Braita, Ein Me'idin al Hashuma. You cannot identify a dead body to allow his wife to get married based on a mole. Rabbi Eliezer ben Mahavai, Omer, yes, you can. If it's a mole that is in a specific place with a specific color, so then yes. Now, I'm assuming that the machlokas between the Tanakama and Rabbi Eliezer ben Mahavai is exactly this issue, that Mar Sava Simonim D'Oraisa. So according to Rabbi Eliezer ben Mahavai, who says you can, he holds that it's a D'Oraisa issue, and the Rabbanan say, no, Simonim work for giving back money, but they don't work for a D'Oraisa. So that would explain the difference in terms of the Gittin. Amar Rava, no, no, no. Absolutely, emphatically not. This is not about Simonim D'Oraisa. It's very possible that everybody agrees that Simonim are D'Oraisa. And that the point over here is that we are talking about a mole which is found on Ben Gilo. And that's the question. The question is whether people who share a common environment and who were born at the same time and who have the same mazel, that's called the Ben Gilo. And this, of course, was deeply part of the belief system that people that are born under the same stars, so to speak, and there's plenty of idiots that believe that today when they look in the newspaper for today's horoscope and so on, they will know everything that's going to happen to them. So anyway, the Ben Gilo, now this, by the way, this has tremendous impact on reality, as I hope you're aware of, that most of the things that are culturally specific diseases are simply diseases that are created because of the way that people relate to their environment. This is an unbelievable phenomenon, but this is so profoundly true that some of the diseases that people suffer from, believe me, you would faint if you heard about them. And some of the diseases that people don't suffer from, there'd be people who would say, what? So, I mean, as you know, it's only in Western countries that people have ever heard of PMS or chronic fatigue syndrome or any number of other things, which they have no idea what you're talking about. If you go to Tanzania, who? What? Never heard of it. It never happens. And I'm sure if you live anywhere but Nigeria, there is certainly no death penalty for stealing someone's genitals, right? But this is serious stuff if you're in Nigeria or other places, and so on and so forth. I mean, it's insane the difference of what people actually experience. So the point over here is if Ben Gilo would have the same Shuma, maybe that's the machlokas, whether that is possible. So the Tanakama holds that a Ben Gilo would actually possibly have the same kind of mole, whereas Rabbi Eliezer ben Mahavai says there's no such thing. If there is a mole, it's unique. Or others say that what Rava was saying was like this, that everybody agrees, yes, that Simonim are D'Oraisa, but the question is over here whether a mole will change its coloration and so on after death. That's the question. So, you cannot match a mole to a known description because After death, the mole is different. Whereas Rabbi Eliezer ben Mavoi holds, you don't have to worry about it. Or there's a whole totally different misera about what Rava said. That Omar Rava, the opposite. Everybody holds simonim are only derabbanan. But over here, what we are talking about, v'hacha, we are talking about over here a siman muvhak. It's not just a mole. It's a very unique mole. Is it called a siman muvhak? One man, the armor holds that a specific place. And we have this discussion, by the way, legabe gitim. Let's say somebody gives a siman. There's a hole in the get in the third line. Or somebody gives a siman. There's a hole in the get next to the top of the letter yud in the third word of the third line. Now that is different. So there is such thing as a siman muvak, as we saw before, and then there's simanim that are mishniim, secondary, and then there's simanim that are bechlal not simanim. Oh, the get was actually discolored. Tons of parchment of paper that's discolored. Okay. So now, lahach lishna the amar Rava simanim d'oraisa. The first two versions we had that, according to Rava, simonim are deraisa. So then how katani, why does our Mishnah say that they're not deraisa? It says alpha pishyesh simonim begufo bekelav, we can't rely on it. That means simonim that are not viewed as serious simonim. Let's say, oh, he was very tall, body was very tall. How many people you know that are 6 feet tall? Ah, oh, come on. Oruch, or gutz, he's only 5 feet tall. Nu. And kelav? Kelav, you can't rely on no matter what, because how do we know that Akiva didn't lend a scarf to somebody? So that is definitely not a siman. Chashinan l'sheila, he might have lent his scarf. Wait a minute. I thought if we believe that people are going to, we need to take into consideration the possibility that somebody lent something, how is it that in Bava Metzia we said that you're allowed to return a donkey based on the simen of the ukaf, which is the donkey's blanket, similar to a saddle on a horse? I mean, maybe somebody borrowed it. No, what are you nuts? Nobody lends a saddle. Because if you use somebody else's saddle and it doesn't match, it's like wearing somebody else's orthopedic shoe. I mean, you got to be nuts. So you will completely kill that animal. I mean, you got to rub the skin off and so on. Nobody would ever do that. Nobody borrows a saddle. Or shaili inchi ukaf. It's not really a saddle, but it's the equivalent of a saddle. I'm using the word saddle, but it's really an ukaf is more like a heavy blanket. Anyway, but what about the case you just brought? You said in the case of the get, you said if you found the get on his keys, his arliki, his signet ring, and so on, Maybe he lent it out. Don't be silly. What idiot would lend out a signet ring? That's the same thing as lending someone your credit card. Can I borrow your credit card? Sure, no problem. Get out of here, man. So if you give somebody a signet ring in those days, that is lending him a credit card. Nobody's going to lend a credit card. Chayish l'ziyufi. This person will be able to counterfeit whatever he wants, right? And there's a reason why nobody ever gives out a keys, which is like a money bag or a wallet, because there's this weird belief that people have that if, and we're talking about weird beliefs here, that if you lend somebody your wallet, you are giving him your mazel. Yeah, so you wouldn't want to do that, right? I once had a lovely credit card. Where? And this is when the bank used to assign the code to your credit card. So, and I would always give a simon for, because I would never remember the code. But over here, the credit card was 4050. Now, when I realized the code is MUN, aha, I figured you could just take whatever you want, whenever you want. It worked great until the credit card ended up being changed by the bank. But anyway, so who would lend out a credit card like that? Okay, so Menachashayinchi Velo Mushle, you're afraid that you're giving away your mazel. Or, you know, why don't I tell you something else? When we're talking about, I'll give you the same answer I gave about his body. He's tall, he's short. The same thing is true about the things that he's wearing. It was a red scarf. It was a white scarf. I mean, that What kind of siman is that? How many red scarves are there? So that's not called a siman at all. So we have three levels of siman. Siman muvak, the siman mishni, which is in the middle, and then we have things that are bichlal, not called simonim. And then on top of all of that, we have what's known as tfiut ayin, which is that I know, but I simply cannot give you objective criteria. Now, the Mishnah says, even if you see that he's cut up, that you cannot be made that he's dead. Are you trying to say that somebody who is cut up to that extent is going to survive? Veramino, what are you going to do with the Mishnah in Ohalot? The Mishnah in Ohalot says that a person is not metame ba'ohel until he is dead. I don't care if he is cut up into pieces. This is maguyad. I don't care if he's literally goses after having been cut up, as Tosis explains. The tumah is not going to come until he's dead. Now, that's mashma, that this is a special din in tumah tamed, not in the question of whether he's going to die. He's dead, except he's not dead yet. But certainly in terms of being made that he's dead, you should be able to be made to be dead. Ha-michya lo-chaye. Answers the Gemara, lo-kasha. We know that there's a machlokas between Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar and the Rabbanan. Our Mishnah is going according to Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. This Mishnah in Olos is going according to Rabbanan. The Tanya. The Braita says that me'idin ala meguyad ve'en me'idin ala tzaluf. You can actually be made even if you didn't see the person die, but if he's been cut up to the extent that he's got only moments to live, you can. But you cannot be made just because he is hung up on a cross. How do you know somebody didn't cut him down and give him water and so on and give him up some blood? Rav Shimon ben Elazar omer, af ala meguyad ein me'idim. You can never, ever be made at all. Why? Because if you've got the right instruments, he can be saved. Can you cauterize the wound? Yes. So then maybe it was cauterized. Maybe the guy didn't die. I mean, how do you know what kind of surgery was performed over here? And then did the chazanish pass because this halacha lemaisa? All of these klolim do not apply in the correct surgical tools. Even legabe the din of trefa lo chaye. Fine. So the Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar says you can never be made because there might be surgical tools available. Sheyacholi kavod v'lichyot. You could always cauterize the wound, right? So our Mishnah, which says that the guy may survive and therefore you cannot say that he's dead. Okay, that's going according to Shimon ben Elazar. Masha Enkein, the Mishnah talks about it's just a din in tumas ames. That's going a little bit of Rabbanan. Excuse me? Our Mishnah is going like Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. So what do you do with the Seifa of the Mishnah? V'katani Seifa. Later on, tomorrow's the continuation, it's going to say, well, there was this Maisa in Asia. You know, these guys were having a great time going skin diving, you know. And this guy pulls on the rope and says, pull me up. He gives the three pulls. They pull him up, but unfortunately, all that they pull up is a leg. The rest of him has disappeared. Now, this person obviously has had some kind of unfortunate encounter with a shark or something, right? So now, it's a pretty sad case. So, lo al tabi adam el raglo, the only thing that came up was his foot. And the Chachamim said, well, if the foot that came up was basically included the area above the knee, so then that is enough to say that his wife can get married. But if it was below the knee, then his wife can't get married. Now, if you're going to Shimon ben Elazar, even wherever it was, I mean, it's true, it's a horrible injury, but you never know. There might have been Jules Verne in his submarine and got the guy and maybe cauterized the wound so he could have survived. No? No. Shiny Maya, it's different when you're in the water. It's much worse because Maya Marzumaka, the water is going to get in there and it's going to mess up everything. It's going to be no way to fix him. But Rabbi Bar Bar Chana said that it's absurd to say that you could cure a meguyad with just cauterization. I myself saw, Ledidi Chazal Yehutaya, I saw an Arab got angry at his camel who was acting up and the camel was sitting there and I don't know what the sound is that camels make in English. In Hebrew, it's called na'ar, no air. So, do you know, Barnea, what sound does a camel make? Who's got a kid of about 2 years old? Does he know what a lion sounds like?
It seems that they say braying, you know, like mules, braying.
Braying, no air means braying, but camels really bray? Okay, whatever it is, I guess it's close enough. So anyway, this camel was giving him a hard time and was shouting at the top of his voice. And this Arab took his sword, cut the camel up, and before it even finished its bray, it was dead and it stopped, right? Velo afsikelana ruse, and it hadn't even had time to finish. You see, it's instantaneous. How are you going to cauterize something that's instantaneous? Come on, says Abaya. What kind of riot is that? You're going to start giving me medical advice, Mishnah advice based on anecdotal evidence? That was a weak camel. I don't know. But if you're talking about a perfectly healthy camel, then maybe you could have been cauterized. Or there may be another simple solution. Maybe our Mishnah is talking about that he was meguyad with a white hot knife, and therefore the white hot knife cauterized the wound as it cut him. So therefore meguyad, and there's going everybody, because even the Rabbanan would agree that in the event that the cauterization took place simultaneously with the wound. And what about the lion nibbling on this guy? What about that case? So if you see a chaya ochelet, amr of yudam shmuel, you can't be made, but that's talking about where the alligator is chomping on his hand. If the alligator's chomping on his heart, I think we can actually testify that this guy is kaput. So lo shano elam imokam she'inav sho'yotza, imokam she'inav sho'yotza, you can be made. The Omer of Yudam HaShmuel, if somebody slits a guy's throat and both simonim, both the esophagus and the trachea are cut through barov, and this guy runs away, you didn't see him actually die, you can still be made that he's dead by the time you got to the Beis Din. Is that true? Wait a minute. You're saying he has a din of being dead just because his throat was slit? If the guy says, he can't really talk, but he could write or he could be Romes, write a get to my wife quick so that she doesn't fall to Yibum and so on, right? So they are allowed to write that get and give the get to his wife, and they do not assume that he's instantly going to die. Yes, I didn't say he's going to instantly die. He is alive. I'm just saying he is not going to live long, so by the time they get to Beis Din, they can be sure that he's dead. Wait a minute. So then if that's true, let's say that somebody let a knife drop and it was in a way that he would be high of gullus as an accidental drop. So he was climbing up a ladder, and all the cases that we had, it wasn't fully his fault. The knife drops and slices a guy's throat. So now he's got a slit throat. So then if you're telling me that that is a direct cause of death, then why does he not have to go into galut? Aloma tanya shachat shleim arov shleim areza eno gole. It says that that person does not go into galut, so apparently it is not an immediate cause of death. Says the Gemara, that's a different situation. Itmar Loma Rav Hoshaya, that's because in order to be Mechayev him, we need to know that it was the sole factor in the guy's death. But in this case, we cannot be sure it's the sole factor, because Chayshin and Shema HaRuach Bilbilatu. Look, I mean, a person who's got a slit throat, very possibly that was exacerbated because of the fact that the wind was blowing and it actually tore it apart, made it worse. Or maybe he himself was kirev mitato. Maybe he was thrashing around and going nuts and thereby exacerbated the wound, died more quickly. And the difference between those two approaches would be, okay, on the one hand, he could have accidentally slit his throat in a place where there's no wind, so it was inside a completely enclosed, so to speak, marble house, and the guy did move around. Or it could be that he actually had dropped the knife outdoors, but the guy did not move about at all. And let's just finish these last closing words. Rabbi Huda says, look, you can't give a general rule on this. I mean, not all people, not all places, not all hours are the same. What did he mean to say? The Rabbi Huda ben Bava, was he saying sometimes it could be longer than 3 days? Or was he saying you can't say 3 days because there's lots of places where you can't do 3 days? You should give a shorter. I mean, was it lekula or lechumra? Tosis points out that obviously it doesn't have to be one or the other. It could be let's make a case-by-case decision. Gemara's initial take on this is that he's coming to give a general idea. Look, don't focus on 3 days and assume it's good. Or he might say, don't focus on more than 3 days and assume it's bad. But obviously, once we would have established that, we would have said, is it even on a case-by-case basis? Yes, we would have, but we never even get to that point. Because, Tashma, there was this guy who drowned in this town of Carmi. And they brought him, his body was brought onto dry ground by Bei Hadaya, and that was 3 days later. Labata Tlata Yumin and Revdimi Minarda said his wife got married based on that, even though it was 3 days later. And there was another guy who drowned in the Diglat River. They brought him by the bridge. They found his body stuck in the edges of the bridge of the Shabistana, which all in Barnea's neighborhood. And Ansra
is the Hideka.
Yes. And in Sivarav, Ledevitu Apuma de Tushushbine, and on the basis of his good friends who were able to identify him 5 days later, Lebata Chamisha Yumi. So now, if you're going to tell me that Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava allows us to determine even later than 3 days, then these Rabbanan were going like Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava. But if you're telling me, no, Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava says you can't rely, you have to be more machmer, so then they weren't relying on anybody. So, you know, come on, Avi. No, come on, this is different. You're talking about cases over here of drowning. Now, drowning in those areas, the water is cold. And cold water will preserve the body from decomposition. And therefore, you can't bring a raya, because maybe even a month later, if it was freezing cold water, you could still find a perfectly preserved corpse. What? You said before that in the water, things are worse. You said that if a shark got him, there's no way that we could fix him if it's in the water. Excuse me. One case is talking about where a shark bit off his leg, and the other case is talking about where the guy drowned. If there is a makkah, so then yes, the water will definitely make things worse. But if there is no makkah, then the cool water will preserve the body, and mitzmatzomit, it's going to keep the body contracted, not bloat. Now, all of this, however, is that when they brought the body up, they immediately identified it. But if they allowed even an hour to go by after submersion in water, when you take the body out of water, then it's going to decompose very rapidly. And take a look what happened to Saruman. I mean, this guy might have been living for hundreds of years. Look how fast he decomposed. My God, he turned into dust in no time at all. Sorry to have seen such a thing here. But the idea is that you'd have to immediately identify him. Aval ishtohi mitfach tofach. If it took any time beyond that, then you're going to have to worry. This is the way that the Rama actually learns it. Anyway, I got some really nice stories for you. But, okay, we've run out of time. So hopefully we'll get a chance to tell you stories tomorrow. Anyway, kol tov, everyone. Have a wonderful day. Thank you for allowing me to keep you these extra moments so we get up to the Yalaka Mishnah, which is lovely.